Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and there's the music. On today's show, the latest on the proposed data centers in Northeast Pennsylvania, and what folks learned at a recent town hall. The Grateful Dead played their first ever New York show at Woodstock in Bethel back in 1969. More than five decades later, that musical legacy is still drawing devoted fans to the Catskills. We'll hear from Jeff Mattson of Dark Star Orchestra ahead of the band's return to Bethel Woods this weekend. Plus, how Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream is being transformed into an interactive musical adventure for families in Sullivan County. It's a special performance by the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra, inviting audiences of all ages to explore storytelling through live music. And June is Dairy Month. And today we get to meet the Wayne County Dairy Ambassadors. I think one of them is even a princess. We'll learn how they're promoting one of the region's most important agricultural industries. After the news.
President Trump stunned Washington yesterday when he reversed course on signing bipartisan legislation to lower housing prices across the country. Trump canceled a bill signing ceremony for the measure, saying that his pet issue, an election bill, had to be first. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports.
It speaks to bigger issues about Trump's efforts to expand his executive power and political power, and the loyalty he expects from those he works with. That includes U.S. allies, who he has been frustrated with for not supporting him enough in the war on Iran.
I just want their loyalty. We don't need their money. We don't need anything. We have the most powerful military in the world by far. But I just want loyalty. You know, we're so loyal to them.
Political strategists say Trump is more focused on loyalty, including Republicans being loyal to him rather than having the necessary majorities who can pass his legislation. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is touring Gulf Arab states to discuss an interim peace deal between the U.S. and Iran. NPR's Aya Betraoui reports Rubio is wrapping up his visit today with a summit of Gulf foreign ministers in Bahrain after stops in the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait.
Rubio says he's in the Gulf to thank Arab states for their, quote, incredible support throughout the war and to engage them about decisions going forward. Iran accused Gulf Arab states of allowing U.S. forces to launch attacks from their territory during the war. Iran targeted these countries with missiles and drones that hit bases, but also energy infrastructure, airports, and residential areas. Despite this, Rubio says the security partnership remains strong. The interim agreement with the U.S. focuses on curbing Iran's nuclear program. Its missile and drone capabilities are not part of the deal. Aya Betraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
Stocks on Wall Street opened higher today as the Commerce Department reported a jump in annual inflation. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose by about 350 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in May were up 4.1% from a year ago, according to the Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely watched by the Federal Reserve. Higher energy prices caused by the war with Iran are partly to blame. Investors are betting the central bank will have to raise interest rates later this year. The U.S. economy grew a bit faster in January, February, and March than had been reported. New figures from the Commerce Department show the nation's gross domestic product grew at an annual rate of 2.1% during the quarter, up from an earlier estimate of 1.6%. The change largely reflects a downward revision in imports, which count against GDP. Consumer spending during the quarter was also a bit weaker than had been reported. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up 376 points. This is NPR. Dozens of Kenyans took to the streets today under heavy security to honor protesters killed during anti-government demonstrations 2 years ago. The unrest began in Nairobi over proposed tax hikes and the rising cost of living. Organizers planned commemorative marches in both the capital and the coastal city of Mombasa to mark the anniversary of the June 25th protests. A massive heat wave continues to grip much of Western Europe. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports a popular gallery in Florence, Italy, was forced to suspend ticket sales after its air conditioning units failed.
The air conditioning at the Uffizi Gallery buckled in the extreme temperatures that have reached 96.8 Fahrenheit in Florence and are expected to climb even higher today. Operations are underway to mend the units, but in the meantime, new ticket sales have been suspended until Monday, the gallery says. Those with existing reservations can enter, but only at staggered times to reduce crowding. This has created long, snaking lines of visitors waiting outside in the heat. Italy's health ministry has placed 16 cities, including Florence, Milan, Rome, Turin and Verona, on its highest heat alert. The World Meteorological Organization says Europe is warming at twice the global average. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
A powerful earthquake struck off Japan's northern coast today. The magnitude 7.2 quake hit during the morning rush hour and was felt across northeastern Japan, with tremors reaching Tokyo. I'm Winter Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And we've been reporting on large-scale data center proposals throughout the rural parts of northeastern Pennsylvania and the upper Delaware River region, and how local officials are racing to determine how and whether to regulate an industry that many residents had never expected to confront. Following along and giving us the latest updates is Liam Mayo, news editor of the River Reporter, and he joins us now with the latest. Liam, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
So the last time we talked, I know that there were a couple of townships there in northeast Pennsylvania discussing some ordinances. Let's talk about Berlin Township. Let's remind folks what's being proposed there and what's on the table for folks to consider.
Yeah. So for Berlin Township, there was an ordinance that they were discussing, just to go over a couple of the quick things that it addresses. It orders data center applicants to fulfill specific requirements, such as submitting anticipated traffic patterns and economic and environmental impact analyses. It addresses water, electric, and nuclear energy studies. It requires policies to prevent the harmful use of AI, such as AI models displaying harmful bias or violations of civil rights and civil liberties. So this was the ordinance that was kind of under consideration, and this was the ordinance that went to a public hearing and then was passed by the Berlin Township Board of Supervisors on June 16. And at that public hearing, the people who turned out expressed both gratitude to the supervisors as well as concern that the ordinance was not sufficient. They were, you know, praising certain aspects of those ordinances and praising that there was going to be an ordinance in place, while also saying, like, hey, there are other things that we should try and include. There are other things that this ordinance doesn't address. And what the township supervisor's sort of response was that essentially the township needed to have something in place. Like, it was better to have any ordinance in place that could then later be amended rather than have a proposal come to town and find sort of no ordinances or no regulations in place. So this was the township's first draft. One of the supervisors stated that the ordinance had been developed in 30 days by the township and that they were currently compiling ordinances from other townships and boroughs to find additional content for amendment. So this was sort of the town's board of supervisors said this was the township's first pass at regulating this industry, but they were aware that this was their first pass, that this is not the final word on how this stuff is going to be regulated in this township.
And how are residents in Berlin Township reacting?
Yeah, residents were generally, like, pleased that the township was doing something. I'm just trying to see if I can bring this up. There was a specific resident there who also submitted a letter to the editor sort of talking, or just with his comments on the ordinance. He says in that letter, quote, "I believe the ordinance is largely successful in bringing coherence and mitigation to what is potentially a terrible development in our midst. If you live locally, data centers erected in your vicinity will be life-altering." Then it kind of goes on to mention, hey, there are some other things that aren't in this ordinance that perhaps should be in there. And that was, I think, the view shared by a lot of the other people in attendance, where like there was praise for the supervisors putting something in attendance, but a recognition that like the ordinance as it is has holes in it, has other things that aren't necessarily brought up.
That resident John Pace submitted a letter to the editor, basically a transcript of his remarks from that meeting, and it's in the River Reporter on the opinion pages. He says at the end that he believes the township supervisors are acting responsibly by enacting this ordinance, and their effort has my support, he quotes. Do you feel that that's the sentiment for a lot of the residents there, that the township supervisors are acting responsibly?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's the feeling of a lot of residents in the area, that any kind of ordinances put in place are worthwhile ordinances. And we'll talk a little bit later on sort of about a community forum where that feeling was also expressed. One thing, our reporter, Avery Olliger, also sort of reached out to a couple of other experts in the field of planning and development to sort of talk about the way these ordinances and this kind of regulation is often done. And those people he talked to kind of emphasized that if you really want to do this kind, or like really fine tuning of regulation of development, the best way to do that is to have a zoning ordinance in place. And it's through a zoning ordinance that you can do most of this stuff. Berlin's is not through zoning, as Berlin does not itself have zoning. There are around half of Wayne County's townships and boroughs do not have zoning. This was also something briefly discussed at the meeting itself, where Barbara Arendelle, director of Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, promoted zoning as something that, quote, gives you control of your land in a much more thorough way. Whereas sort of supervisors told the River Reporter that there are no current plans to institute a zoning for it in the future. So I think there's the broad acceptance that it's good to have something in place, but both in Berlin Township and elsewhere in the region, there's the this development coming to the area is raising the questions about how townships and boroughs should regulate their land use more holistically, whether the way they've been doing it is sufficient or whether there should be new zoning regulations or just zoning at all to be able to address these new things as they come in.
Now, over in Damascus Township, they are considering a data center ordinance. So let's explain to folks what's going on there, because there was also this proposed solar development there.
Yeah, Damascus is a township that has been sort of eyed for a lot of solar development. And there, while one of them sort of has been withdrawn, there are others that are still under discussion and still potentially going forward. Damascus Township talked at its June 15 meeting, about a couple of those projects. Honesdale Solar One LLC requesting an extension of its conditional use permit, sort of extending the timeline for its project to be completed with a target date of completion July 2027. This is a project that is kind of on the Damascus-Lebanon Township border. So there's still solar development going on in Damascus, but in terms of their approach to data centers, the update there is fairly short. Damascus put a moratorium into place to give itself time to consider a data center ordinance. And there was a brief update from the Board of Supervisors saying that that work is sort of soon coming to a close, where the Planning Commission is planning to meet July 1, and it plans to have the proposed data center ordinance ready to present to the Board of Supervisors at the July meeting, which is July 20. So come next month, there should be more to report in terms of what direction Damascus is looking to take in its ordinance.
And because of all of these different proposals that are, you know, racing across the rural northeast Pennsylvania area, the River Reporter, in collaboration with Wayne, is it Wayne County Voices? Is that the group? Yeah.
Yeah. Wayne County Voices was the group. It's a nonpartisan group that was organizing this forum. We were the media partners to sort of help get the word out a little bit about the work that they were doing.
A town hall forum that you guys hosted this past weekend. What happened at that, and what was the things that folks learned, and any sort of action items that came out of it?
Yeah. So there weren't a ton of audience members in attendance. It was a sort of mid Saturday afternoon with, I think, a lot of other community events going on. So maybe some of the potential expected attendees were at some of the other wonderful events happening out in the community. There were like four panelists who talked, representatives from national groups, Physicians for Social Responsibility and Sierra Club, as well as residents kind of from sort of more local environmental nonprofits, Known Grove SLS and Damascus Citizens for Sustainability. And I would say the overall mood was this community forum was less of a lecture hall and more of a war room where these panelists were sort of sharing tips and discussion on how to push back against data centers. Everyone was on the same page about the potential harms that could come from data centers coming into a community, and we're just trying to strategize about the ways to push back against this. And I think one of the overall points that came out of it was the idea that there are things you can do. They talked about the zoning and other ordinances as ways you can push back against this. They talked about the sort of importance of regulations that protect the environment of a given area, protect the forests and the aquifers of a given area, not just from data center development specifically, but from like the whole spectrum of development that can clear cut forests and that can harm aquifers. Like the importance of having a regulatory framework that takes the long-term health and sustainability of the environment into consideration. They talked about holding sort of legislators accountable, legislators at the county level, legislators at the state level and the federal level. There are a lot of bills floating around in Pennsylvania specifically to regulate data centers, or to put a moratorium out, or to make sure data centers pay their proper taxes, or to do X, Y, and Z. And there was an emphasis on making sure legislators like push for the best of those possible options. And there was also just a lot of discussion about how people need to push their local municipal leaders to be brave too, where local municipal leaders can sort of think that there isn't anything they can do, or that, there are limits to what they can do. But if there was an emphasis on community members sort of pushing back against that fear or against that hesitation and saying like, yeah, there are these ordinances you can put into place. There are these zoning things you can put into place. There are things we can do as a community to decide what our future is going to look like. It's not an inevitability that these major development projects are going to come into our area.
Meanwhile, in Pennsylvania and Harrisburg, there is a different approach to data centers than there currently is on the New York side. New York has passed a moratorium that's waiting for Governor Hochul's signature. But in Pennsylvania, a proposal backed by Governor Josh Shapiro would tie tax incentives for data centers to environmental, energy, and transparency requirements. It cleared a key hurdle in the Pennsylvania House this week with bipartisan support. It would restructure their existing tax exemption for data center equipment, making it available only to projects that may meet specific standards related to environmental protection, energy use, and community engagement. The supporters of that say that's intended to address these concerns about the rapid growth of data centers and their impact on local communities. A separate bill House lawmakers passed enabling municipalities to pass moratoriums on major data center projects. while they try to address these specific zoning laws we're talking about right now. And both of those measures now move to the Pennsylvania Senate for consideration. So lots of activity on the Pennsylvania side when it comes to data center zoning and moratoriums and how you're going to handle it. Liam Mayo has been on top of it for us from the River Reporter. You can read more about his reporting at theriverreporter.com. Liam, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
Now, in New York, two pieces of proposed legislation before the New York State Legislature aimed at expanding and protecting access to gender-affirming care did not receive a vote this legislative session. As the New York Public News Network's Sanjina Shrestha reports, some who access that care are worried about the inaction amid federal restrictions.
Queenie Royale says she cannot afford to be lazy when it comes to appearances. The 26-year-old says she has to make sure everything in the mirror looks just right, even when she heads out to work out in her neighborhood. She says as a trans woman, it's not about vanity, it's about personal safety.
I don't know who's going to see me. And I don't know what they think. You never know who you're going to encounter. So I think that's just a really big thing of like knowing how you look, knowing how people perceive you, and doing everything in your power to protect yourself.
Royale says gender-affirming healthcare, which helps bring a person's gender expression in line with their gender identity, also serves as a form of shield for many in the gender non-conforming community.
We do not have the luxury to be lazy. We have to go through all of the, pretty much a checklist before we go outside, even if I'm checking the mail. It's pretty much of like looking in the mirror, making sure that everything is everything. Everything looks right. Not as far as like I can't go outside in my pajamas. I can definitely do that. But I have to make sure that I look presentable because of the things that could happen, you know?
She says this is why she's concerned for her community as the Trump administration advances regulations and restrictions targeting people's access to gender-affirming care. Those regulations range from limits on how federal Medicaid dollars can cover gender-affirming care to healthcare providers being subpoenaed to release information on who accessed that care through their systems. Those worries have been amplified after the New York State legislative session came to a close without votes to advance two bills to expand and protect gender-affirming care. One of the bills, which would advance the gender-affirming care access program, called for providing support to agencies offering this form of health care. State Senator Kristen Gonzalez, the Democrat who sponsored the bill, says while it had support from both the Senate and the Assembly, the bill needed more allies.
That line item fell out altogether. And I think it's really important to ensure now more than ever we're expanding funding and access to care for trans youth, but that we have a partner in the executive in doing so.
Key Williams, the executive director at New Pride Agenda, says the bill was part of an effort to expand access to gender-affirming care beyond New York City. It focused on areas where there are little to no healthcare systems that provide this kind of care, or if they do, have long wait lists.
There already is a lack of gender-affirming care access across the state of New York, and therefore these two programs would have helped us continue to be able to provide gender-affirming care in New York State.
Another bill proposed was a Gender-Affirming Care Act. It would have codified protections for people accessing care through Medicaid by ensuring coverage regardless of federal funding. The push for this legislation came as the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued two federal proposals. The proposals aimed to prohibit most Medicare and Medicaid-enrolled hospitals from providing gender-affirming care to youth, while also prohibiting federal Medicaid programs from covering this form of care. While these two federal proposals are still under consideration, some New Yorkers who access care say they are worried and confused. Royale says the back and forth of the proposals has led to people either delaying care or forgoing it altogether.
I specifically actually work with someone who is worried about switching insurance coverage because they won't cover the medication, worried about if they will, because there's a specific type of testosterone that they have to take. That's also a worry of like if they will cover it or not. And if they won't cover it, it's trying to find a new managed care provider that will cover it. And if Medicaid is not a thing, that's going to be even another, you know, issue.
The Gender Affirming Care Act was advanced to a third reading, but failed to move out of the Senate Rules Committee. That's the final committee a bill needs to pass before receiving a vote on the Senate floor. Williams says for the next legislative session, their coalition is going to shift the message to focus on gender-affirming care as a push for health care.
healthcare is a winning message. And so that's one of the things that we're thinking about, especially going into and knowing that right now we're in obviously an election season, is understanding that we need leadership that's going to invest in gender affirming care. We need leadership that is going to stand in the values of believing that healthcare is a necessary right.
Senator Gonzalez adds that with everything happening on the federal level, she hopes the urgency for the need of this form of care will push these bills forward when they are proposed again next year. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Sujina Shrestha.
Still to come, a conversation with Jeff Mattson of Dark Star Orchestra, returning to Bethel Woods this weekend to celebrate the music and spirit of the Grateful Dead. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Summer is here and we're ready to boogie. At the Radio Catskill Dance Party happening Saturday under the stars at the Keshecton Pump House, featuring Radio Catskill DJs, Jason Tuga of The Mixtape with dance classics from the 70s through the 90s, and Jeff Barnes of Electric Mountain spinning techno, house, and indie beats. Come out and dance with Radio Catskill this Saturday, 7 to 10 at the Keshecton Pump House. $10 suggested donation at the door.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Famous 1960s San Francisco band, you may have heard of them, the Grateful Dead, played their first show in upstate New York 67 years ago this summer. And they did it right here in the Catskills at the 1969 Woodstock Music and Arts Fair. Since then, their music has been a perennial part of summertime in the Catskills, even long after the original band stopped touring. That tradition continues this weekend when Dark Star Orchestra returns to Bethel Woods, performing two long sets of Grateful Dead music to grateful fans. To learn more, Radio Catskill's Jason Dole spoke with Jeff Mattson, lead guitar player and vocalist for Dark Star Orchestra.
Jeff Mattson, welcome to Radio Catskill.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
So you're coming back to Bethel Woods. You're playing the Horizon stage on Saturday. What can folks expect?
Well, as usual for Dark Star Orchestra, we're going to be performing two sets of Grateful Dead music. Typically, we either recreate a show that the Grateful Dead, a set list that the Grateful Dead played over their 30-year history, or every third or fourth night, we make up a set of our own. So, but we don't really announce very often what we're going to do, so it'll be a mystery.
Yeah, I figured you might not want to give too much away, so you know there's no spoilers here. But even when you guys kind of constitute your own sets, it seems like you still kind of preserve the vibe of what the Dead might do for a first set versus the second set. You kind of keep that feeling.
Well, yeah, something like. But we'll also do things where we'll juxtapose songs that never were played back to back before. You know. Pick a song from one era that, and maybe segue into something that they played much later when they had stopped playing the first song. You know, experiment without that kind of thing. It's a way to experiment with different kinds of segues. But like you said, you know, the first set will typically be more the shorter songs, you know, sort of a warm up to the second set, and the second set's can frequently be one continuous jam, you know, going from song to song, the longer form songs in the second set.
Yeah. Do you notice when you play these days, are there still new people discovering the Grateful Dead?
Absolutely. I wouldn't know what the percentage is, but there's quite a few people out there, maybe half that were not, maybe more, I don't know, that we're not old enough to have seen the actual Grateful Dead. And all the different formations that they played after the Grateful Dead ended, you know, the Dead and the Other Ones and Rat Dog and Felon Friends and Dead and Company. A lot of people have gotten to see those bands, but they weren't around to see Jerry Garcia play.
The listener might not be that familiar with the Grateful Dead or have more of a knowledge of them beyond the name. Do you have any advice for newcomers, for people that are just discovering the music or attending their first Grateful Dead-related live event?
Well, I would say to expect the unexpected, in the sense that the Grateful Dead never played the same set list from show to show like so many bands do, but there's nothing wrong with that. But you go see a band, say, like the Eagles or something, and they're going to play the same show every night. And with the Grateful Dead, it's not only going to be different songs in different orders, but they never play the songs the same way twice. So I think it really appeals to people who have a sense of musical adventure and are not looking for something that's real prepackaged and has that sense of danger. That things can happen in the moment, and it can be brilliant. Sometimes it's not so brilliant, but that's the trade-off you get for being experimental.
Yeah. I'm talking to Jeff Mattson, lead guitarist and vocalist with the Dark Star Orchestra. You can play in a lot of styles, and you kind of have to, because Jerry and the guys played in a lot of styles, but do you find yourself gravitating towards any of those flavors of Grateful Dead more than the other? You got like the rootsy Americana, bluegrass and flavored stuff, or a little bit country, but there's also where they get jazzy, almost jazz fusion. There's a straight up psychedelic, there's a straight up rocking stuff. Do any of those things appeal to you more than the others as you go through the years?
You know, I have, probably thanks to the Grateful Dead, I have very eclectic taste in music. So I would say that I am really interested in all that stuff, the blues, the country, the bluegrassy stuff, like you said, the Americana, the jazzy stuff, the really far out stuff. I love that. I kind of feel like they, led me in a lot of directions, and I appreciate that. Yeah. So, no, I love to play straight-up rock and roll, too. So it's fun that you can play, like, a country song and then play, like, Chuck Berry song next, and then, something jazzy, like Let It Grow or Eyes of the World or something, and then play a beautiful ballad. It's all good stuff.
What's the music that first got you playing guitar?
Well, I grew up, I started listening to music in the late 60s. I was, a preteen, and I started listening to, like, AM radio. I'm from New York City. And then, of course, I got into the Beatles. But the time I started taking guitar seriously, I was already starting in into the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers and the band and George Phils Nash and Young, all that kind of stuff that sort of gravitated toward a little bit looser and jammier music. My father was a jazz musician, so I grew up being exposed to improvisation my whole life, so I think I just naturally gravitated toward, I always liked things that had good melodies, but I liked, I was always attracted to the interesting long guitar solo, help us, Green, Jimi Hendrix, things like that too.
Did you see the original Grateful Dead? And if so, when's the first time you saw them?
The first time I saw it was in 1973 at the Nashville Coliseum. And I saw them hundreds of times, probably over there. Till 1995.
You're the lead guitarist for Dark Star Orchestra, but, I want the listener to understand you've also played with a lot of the original members of the Grateful Dead and the extended Dead family. You played lead in a Donna Jean Godshow band. You also played with Bobby, Phil, Bill Kreutzmann, Mickey Hart over the years, even Tom Constantine. How is working with the folks who made this music originally, how does that inform what you're able to bring to it?
Well, it's the sweetest form of confirmation that we're on the right track. And it's got to be the high point of my musical career, the honor to get to play with these wonderful musicians that I looked up to so much and listened to so much. I always treat it like a learning experience because, you know, they're always trying, we're trying to hear where they want to take it now, you know, in a new way. And that's fun too. It's sad that we've lost Bob, Donna, and Phil in the last couple of years. Donna was a very close friend of mine too, and it's sad that they're gone, but so grateful that I got to perform with them.
Yeah, I mean, we just lost Bobby the beginning of this year. I mean, crazy to think this is going to essentially be like the first summer in more than 60 years that somebody won't be able to see Bob Weir perform live. On August 1st, you're headlining a show at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California, and with a number of other artists in a Grateful Dead extended family, Melvin Seals and the JGB, as well as Peter Rowan and San Grisman Project. The show's called The Music Never Stops, a Rex Foundation benefit and tribute to Bob Weir. And I'm just wondering, like, again, without giving away too many spoilers, how you might plan to pay tribute to Bob Weir at that show, and is that in any way different than how you pay tribute to him at all your other shows?
We're actually playing two nights there, the 31st of July and August 1st. And we have a lot of these guests coming, and we would like to interact with them. And, you know, we have a lot of, we're just talking about the theater. I don't think I can announce anybody, but we have a bunch of guys who played with Bobby over the years coming down to sit in, I think especially on the first night. It haven't been announced, but I think it'll be a real treat. And you know, they get, we get to honor Bob all together. It's right there in the Bay Area. Can't beat that. And of course, August 1st is Darius's birthday, so we'll be honoring him on August 1st too.
Oh, great. Great. Going back to that original Woodstock Festival in 69 real quick, the Grateful Dead were there. We know they had issues. I think even Jerry regarded it as a legendarily bad performance. But when I go back and listen to that recording, I mean, okay, it's not one of their best shows, but and it's definitely short for a Dead concert. But it doesn't seem to be as horrible as the myths would lead you to believe. I'm wondering what your take is on Grateful Dead at Woodstock.
I agree. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think it was a horrible experience for them. They were getting shocked and all kinds of things were going on. But the music is not really that bad. And of course, it's short just because it's a festival set. And it was very late at night, I believe. But no, you know, I mean, 69 Grateful Dead is a beautiful thing in its own way. And, you know, anytime you have a Dark Star, you're doing pretty good. And a nice long love light, I think it deserves another look from its reputation.
Everybody knows Grateful Dead comes from California, and that, like, that's their home. And they really made a name for themselves on the West Coast. But, like, when the Dead started to go national, it seems like New York, both New York City and upstate New York, played a big part in, you know, giving the Dead a good foothold on the East Coast. I'm just wondering if you have any take on that, about like the Grateful Dead connection to New York City or, you know, upstate New York, the colleges that they would play. What do you think of that?
I don't know why that was, but it certainly was the case. I grew up in Queens, and then my teenage years moved out to Long Island, and I live there still. It was always a hotbed for Grateful Dead fans and the whole Tri-State area, the upstate area. Absolutely. I saw many shows upstate, Rochester, Binghamton, Buffalo, you know, all the Syracuse.
I mean, Albany. And some of those shows are like legendary now.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So what's it mean to you to be playing, you know, Grateful? I mean, you play Grateful Dead everywhere, but when you come up to, like, you know, the Catskills, you come up to the original site of Woodstock and play Grateful Dead music, does it have any different feeling? Do you do anything different?
Well, I mean, I recognize the vibe that goes with any place that these wonderful events have taken place and wonderful concerts. So I very much felt it last year when we played there, even though, you know, we're playing on the exact spot but you know, and I really enjoyed the museum there. It was a real treat. So yeah, I mean, I'll definitely be thinking about that. We've been lucky to play a lot of the places Grateful Dead played over the years. You know, Red Rocks and Greek Theater and the Olympia in Paris, the Capitol in Port Chester, New York. You know, all over the country, we've played at a lot of the same spots, and some of the places you've done shows that took place there. Well, that's always been a treat. You always feel that vibe.
I'm talking to Jeff Mattson, lead guitarist and vocalist with the Dark Star Orchestra. Dark Star Orchestra just finalized their summer tour, and all their dates are up at darkstarorchestra.net. And, of course, they'll be playing at Bethel Woods on Saturday on the Horizon stage. Jeff, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, it's certainly been a joy. Thank you, Evan.
Thanks to Jason Dole for that. We should also note that Bethel Woods is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. Coming up, we're going to be joined by the Wayne County Dairy Maids. We're going to talk ice cream, dairy farming traditions, and the events bringing the community together throughout the year. Stay with us. This is Radio Catskill.
Feel like you're just spinning in an endless whirlpool of information? We can help steady you. I'm Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and we point out where you should be paying attention and what you can afford to ignore. Using the media as a lens on our world, we reveal nuance and detail often missed by other outlets. So don't miss On the Media, Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. June is Dairy Month, and in Wayne County, that means celebrating the farmers, families, and dairy products that remain a cornerstone of the local agricultural economy. Joining us this morning are members of the Wayne County Dairy Promotion Team to talk about Dairy Month, how it continues with National Ice Cream Month next month, and upcoming events. And I've got the team here. Normally, I would introduce you, but I'm going to let you introduce yourselves. Let's see. Can you tell me your name and your title? Zoe, you go first.
Okay, so my name is Zoe Tyler. I'm a dairy maid of the Wayne County Dairy Court. My sister, Chloe Tyler, is at soccer practice right now.
Oh,
but
we miss Chloe.
Chloe, she's 13.
Okay, and then who else do we have?
My name is Teresa Tyler, and I'm a little dairy maid.
Okay, so we got Zoe and Teresa, while Chloe's off at practice. So, Zoe, tell us all why June is recognized as Dairy Month.
So, June is recognized as Dairy Month to celebrate all the hardworking farmers that gave us dairy from cows.
Okay. And then that Dairy Month promotion continues into July because that's Ice Cream Month. Why is it recognized as Ice Cream Month?
Because everyone loves ice cream, and it gives us 13 essential nutrients.
There you go. Now, I understand that you guys have a little bit of a competition with the Wayne County Commissioners, an Ice Cream Sunday competition. Tell us a little bit about this friendly competition, or is it friendly?
Some years it can get out of hand, but it's always fun to watch and enjoy. But what we do is we tell the public that June is National Dairy Month and July is National Ice Cream Month. And this will be held, this competition will be held on July 2nd, which there will be two Sundays that will be made, the commissioner side and the Wayne County Dairy Court side. And we're going to see who can build the Sunday fastest, which there will be lots of ice cream, plenty of it. So anyone who wants to come can come. There will be whipped cream, some chocolate syrup, and there will be handouts and coloring books.
Now, have you been practicing, Zoe and Teresa, with this competition? Have you been getting ready to see how fast you can go?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
You're taking it seriously. Something else to take seriously is about how milk and dairy products are integrated into your diet. Talk a little bit about why that's important.
Okay. So dairy is important for your diet because whole milk gives you 13 essential nutrients. Chocolate milk can help your bones grow and helps you get like a better diet after you have like a hard workout or games.
And what we said at the beginning that Chloe is out at practice for soccer. Is there any particular dairy product that might help her rejuvenate after this practice today?
She might end up drinking chocolate milk after.
And what are some of the other events that you guys have going on that are coming up or go on throughout the year?
That are coming up, we have the Wayne County Fair and GDS. And what we do there, we help hand out ribbons to the dairy show. Over the years, sometimes we'll do like parades, we'll be in those. Or every spring we have coronation. And sometimes we'll go into schools and help like teach the kids that like farmers help us get like the nutrients that we need, that milk comes from cows. And like sometimes like the teachers don't even know, so we help them and like help them figure out why we're here and what we do.
And I don't want to miss talking to Teresa. Teresa, what's your favorite part of milking and being on a dairy farm that sells their own dairy products?
I like putting the tubes into the cow's little udders.
Yeah. And Zoe, is there any requirement to be on this this wonderful, important court that you're on, or to run as a princess with Wayne County Dairy?
So to run as a princess, you need to be 16 to 24. You need to at least have a dairy background, or you need to be on the court for 1 year. And a lot of people like misunderstand that, oh, this is just for girls. No, it's open to anyone. And like, say if a boy joins, they'd be a dairy ambassador. And there's like plenty of opportunities when you join the court.
Oh, darn. I just turned 25, so I'm going to miss that deadline. But good to know that it's equal opportunity for all. That is Dairy Maid Zoe Tyler and Little Dairy Miss Teresa Tyler from the Wayne County Dairy Promotion Team talking to us about June being Dairy Month, and hold on, it continues. July is a National Ice Cream Month. Thank you both for being here and for all the work that you're doing to support dairy and agriculture in the area.
You're welcome, and thank you for inviting us for this interview.
Absolutely. Come back whenever you want. Thank you, guys. All right, still ahead on Radio Catskill, Chatskill, we're headed into the enchanted forest of fairies, dreamers, and music. The Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra and DVAA bringing A Midsummer Night's Dream to life this weekend. We'll find out more after a break. It's Radio Chatskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. This weekend, audiences can step into an enchanted forest where music does the storytelling. The Delaware Valley Arts Alliance and the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra are presenting A Midsummer Night's Dream, an interactive family concert inspired by Shakespeare's beloved comedy. And that iconic score, let me play a little bit of that if I can reach over to the CD player. I didn't really prep this very well. Hold on. There's that iconic scoring. Also, the iconic classical kit is here, along with iconic Andrew Trombley from the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra. Hello.
Good morning, Andrew.
Hey, good morning, Kit. How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited that you're going to be doing some Midsummer Night's Dream excerpts. I love that music. And you're also going to be you're also going to be performing the quintet night music of the Streets of Madrid, which I just listened to, but I'd never heard before. And Claude Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. And, you know, we usually talk a lot about the music, but this morning I would really like to hear about the mission of Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra and about the family-friendly focus, I didn't mean that to be so alliterative, of the programs that you're presenting this weekend.
Yeah, of course. I'd be happy to do that. Well, you know, so a little bit of history about Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra. You know, we are a supported project of Mission Cultural Arts. It's a wonderful organization that just celebrated their 15-year anniversary. And after about 5 years of organizing lessons and ensemble opportunities and multimedia arts programming, arts visual, arts and dance, what we were really lacking year-round for our residents was a resident performing arts ensemble that was of the highest caliber that is usually commonly found back in New York. So, you know, it was easy for, well, it wasn't easy, but for people like my parents, it often took a lot of sacrifices and commitments to be able to bring me and my siblings an hour and a half into the city, pay for your parking, pay for your dinner, pay for a whole extravaganza just to go spend, you know, 2 hours of your time to go see a wonderful classical music concert. And that was our inspiration for bringing this back into the city. And then as we were going through our programming, you know, a lot of our programming became interesting, fascinating, sometimes a little bit heady and a little bit heavy, which we didn't think was doing the service of our organization, which was to make sure that we are inspiring younger generations. So that's where we tried to put a lot. And that's not to say the students aren't encouraged to go, because all students come to our concerts for free. That's always been our policy. But we want to make sure that we make music fun, as it is powerful and emotional and intellectual, but fun and entertainment also needs to be the core of what we do. So that was our inspiration behind getting these much more interactive family concerts where people don't have to feel stuffy and tight. They can relax. If you're inspired to make noise because something makes you want to react, well, react. That's what, you know, we need to do when we're listening to music. We're just allow ourselves to be humans. And that's what we're hoping to do with this program, with, I think, a lot of interesting programming that just has a lot of exploratory characters for every listener to enjoy and have fun.
Well, I love the sound of that. It's always great to go to a concert and see kids, and, you know, especially when they're encountering something for the first time.
Sounds like we lost Andrew there.
So while we're getting Andrew back, I just want to give the details so we don't miss that. So there'll be two performances Saturday at 2:00. You'll have this family-friendly chamber concert at the Reformed Presbyterian Church of White Lake. That's right on 17B. So, you know, really easy to find. It's kind of across from White Lake. And then again on Sunday, they'll be partnering with DVAA, and they'll be presenting the concert at the Tustin Theater in Narrowsburg. And that will be at, I think, also at 2:00. So both are at 2:00, one Saturday and one Sunday. And we've got Andrew back. So, Andrew, I just gave the details, and we have maybe about three, four minutes left. So could you give us an idea of about how many musicians you're going to have and what the audience can expect in terms of maybe learning a little bit about the music? Will you be talking about the different pieces?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. So we are going to be going with an 11-piece ensemble. Similar instrumentation to what we had when we did Peter and the Wolf last year. And everything has been arranged, not all by me, but everything has been handpicked and arranged for this concert. So the Boccherini is normally a very iconic string quintet. But then I found wonderful arrangements that started including winds as well. And, you know, while it doesn't do anything profoundly different, a lot of times it's just doubling what the violins have, that extra timbre, all of a sudden the music come alive in a very different sense from imitations of what you might hear on the streets of Madrid back in the 17th century to something a lot closer. Of course, people were playing wind instruments back then. So we're really excited to perform this piece in a very different color, with a very different color landscape than what was originally intended, and as well as a Debussy, a beautiful 11-piece arrangement that we'll be using piano instead of the. But you know, when you play the original orchestration, it's this massive, expansive tonal landscape where you just get to hear washes of sound blend in with one another. And now what we can do with this 11-piece ensemble is we can hyper-focus that listening ability. And not that the Debussy is an oversaturation, but it's so much to listen to. And now we can focus our ears to where are these characters, where are these voices, where is the line moving? And then the Mendelssohn, I think, is at his core, even when writing symphonic music or Elijah, he is a chamber musician at his finest, I think. And his string quartets, piano trios, all incredible pieces of music. But even his symphonic works, his Italian or Scottish, they are performed so often and so well by chamber orchestras, which are often led without a conductor. And that's because his music is engaging from one part to the other. And that's what we're hoping to do with this 11-piece version of Midsummer's Night Dream. And I was lamenting over how long the overture was. I thought it would be an easy arrangement, but then I realized it took a lot more work than I anticipated, because every time I went through the orchestration, Mendelssohn changes these common, these recurring themes just ever so slightly.
Yep.
Every single time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's remarkable. You know, you're talking about a violin going down a third, or just the voices changing a little bit with where the pitch is. And I think it's, again, you know, when you're hyper ears to focus on 11 distinct sounds working together, I think it allows the audience to practice being much more engaged learners.
Well, I'm looking forward to being part of that audience. And, this is just a wonderful way to start the summer. So thank you so much for being with us this morning, Andrew, and I'll see you on the weekend.
Thank you, Kit. Looking forward to it.
Okay, bye-bye.
And there's more information about that special concert coming up Sunday at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. And we're going out on a little bit of a familiar tune.
Yes, which a lot of people don't know. That's Midsummer Night's Dream.
Classical Kit knows. Thanks for joining us, Kit. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay.
I now pronounce this episode of Radio Chatskill to be over. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville, and at vintagehousejville.com, and from listeners like you.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You'll clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, intervals of sunshine and clouds, a thunderstorm could pop up later this afternoon. High 77, a couple of showers and a thunderstorm possible tonight with a low of 59. Tomorrow, a brief shower or two in 78, but it looks like Saturday, partial sunshine, 72, warmer on Sunday and a high of 80. A possible stray afternoon thunderstorm possible then. On Point is next.